Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back a great guest co-host, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Welcome, Jonathan.
Great to be back here.
You know, we are going to have a really interesting guest today on our show, talking with Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, lecturer at Yale, writer in residence at Yale Medical School, and adjunct professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, about her new book, Aroused: The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. I'm very excited about this interview.
I think that hormones are one of the most misunderstood things in the popular press. And so to have a book that gives a little more clarity on that is a great thing.
Well, first, speaking of misunderstood, we're going to help clarify some research that matters. And our very first research is about fear of heights. Do you have any fear of heights?
I typically don't think of myself, but I was hiking last week and definitely did experience some fear, maybe a healthy fear of heights then.
you were looking over that cliff, yeah, and going, I shouldn't look any further.
Yes.
Yeah, I have, I think, a healthy fear, which is like it prevents me from like getting too close to the edge of things at times. And I was recently up at the Biltmore Estate and looking out over one of their ledges, and I was looking down. It was only about 400 feet down, it looked. But I was like, oh, what if my glasses fall? What if my phone falls? Like, just back away. And this research that matters is looking at this fear of heights, something called acrophobia, which is really common, and a way to maybe help people like myself deal with that fear.
This study was done in Europe, and they note that in Europe, one in five people report having a fear of heights.
So I'm not alone.
You're not alone.
I need to go to Europe.
I think so.
But they actually wanting to use a technique with virtual reality to expose people, I guess, through three dimension and other ways to these situations where you may be exposed to high places, but then combine that with maybe some cognitive behavioral therapy, some ways of helping you understand how you can not be fearful or as fearful.
And Adam, we know that exposure therapy works for phobias, but you can't do therapy if you can't get to a therapist. And they noted that not being able to get into a therapist is a significant barrier for many people with phobias, and so they proposed virtual reality as a solution for that.
I think it's really interesting. And this was actually published in the Lancet Psychiatry Journal, and with the half that were exposed to this virtual reality, they found a significant decrease, almost a quarter of whatever the score was going down, which I found significant, meaning people got really good benefits. So I think it's stay tuned. We should be thinking more often about people who have different sorts of phobias and what we may be able to use in our current armamentarium of technology to help them.
I agree. I think that the potential for this to have broad-reaching impact is great.
Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is something I'm actually passionate about, which is, do we need to do reforms in our criminal justice system in order to improve health?
So this is looking at decriminalization of drug offenses. So this is looking at the effects of California's Proposition 47, which reclassified felony drug offenses as misdemeanors. This happened in 2014.
This would be some felony drug offenses, right? I assume if you were transporting a million Percocets across state lines to sell them, that probably wouldn't be reclassified from a felony.
If you were selling cocaine from your yacht, it probably would not be reclassified either.
But if you were probably using marijuana and you happen to have gotten a felony drug offense, and that may well be a misdemeanor, and there was such a push to criminalize things that really were minor drug offenses, and the consequences of that were fairly dramatic around increasing disparities of health, racial and ethnic disparities, which really had dramatic draconian impacts on people's health.
This is something that's infrequently measured, but when it is measured, it's one of the most important things to pay attention to, I think, is what is this step that we do as far as increasing or decreasing disparities? And so a lot of times we have a well-intentioned step that we make in order to help out health, and it actually makes things better only for the people who are better off in the first place. And so to see that this is actually narrowing those disparities makes a huge difference and helps us for those people who actually have addiction as a manifestation of a disease. It helps to be able to provide them with the right treatment medically as well.
And this also had actually positive impacts on crime and recidivism. They found that the rearrest rate and the reconviction rates actually dropped when this proposition had passed. So this is not like, oh, we're going soft on crime. We're actually improving crime statistics through a better policy. This was published in the American Journal of Public Health. Really excited by it. Speaking of excitement, let's talk about our next research that matters. Do you live in a green neighborhood?
Pretty much everything around this area of the country is green this time of year.
That's why people move here. There is a lot of trees, but not everyone lives in green neighborhoods. And the question really is does living around green areas actually improve health? Could it slow cognitive decline, particularly for elderly patients?
This was part of the Whitehall 2 cohort and looked at 6,500 people in the UK. And if you pay attention enough to these things, you'll hear the Whitehall cohort mentioned commonly. It's a study of British civil servants, and they follow a large number of people. And so we get a lot of the best studies of lifetime exposures through the environment or other social factors of health through the Whitehall studies.
And in this particular cohort of 6,500 people, at three different time periods, they were exposed to different sorts of cognitive tests about their verbal and mathematical skills, their fluency in speaking, and their short-term memory, and how those declined. And then they looked at neighborhood green space for each person at these different time periods, and they actually found that living near the green spaces was associated with higher cognitive function and less decline, which is fascinating. It means that it may be associated with all sorts of benefits.
And this is in addition to all the other benefits that we know about green spaces already. Particularly, as the authors point out here, this is important as green spaces diminish in their prevalence and our population continues to age. We can work to target this problem by reversing these trends and hoping to give people more green spaces benefiting their communities.
My mother-in-law moved into a continuing care community, and she values and loves a small porch where she has tons of green things outside that overlooks a forest. And even though it's a small place that she lives in, she has a green thumb, and there are orchids and other flowering things blooming, and even birds coming by.
It's something we know intuitively. It's good to see research supporting it.
Our last research that matters is something that if anyone has a loved one who's had melanoma, you got to pay attention, because there's been literally a transformation landscape that has occurred in the last decade about new treatments for even the most severe advanced melanomas that have metastasized to the brain.
This is using immunotherapy or biologics. And these have been used for all sorts of different diseases. It's revolutionized treatments for cancers, for rheumatologic diseases. And specifically, this was looking at melanoma.
Yeah, and this was published in the journal Cancer Immunology Research. And they basically looked across the country in these research registries of cancer hospitals where they looked at over 2,700 patients who had received these different therapies. And they saw that, for instance, with these immunotherapies, the average survival was 12 and a half months. May not seem great for patients who had melanoma of the brain. However, if they didn't have the immunotherapy, it was 5 months, a four-year survival rate of 28% compared to 11%. So over 100% improvement here, that's pretty dramatic.
The challenging question is that these treatments are quite expensive because this has taken a lot of research to get to this point. And the process to develop these immunotherapies is quite complex. So the authors note that insurance status was a big barrier to obtaining this care. That's one of the key areas for the future direction is, can these treatments become more affordable so that everyone can access them.
And also finding out who benefits and who doesn't, because clearly the majority of people still don't get the benefit. So really, because there have some side effects of these medications, but really promising, kind of exciting, and I'm really looking forward to this research continuing. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, lecturer at Yale, writer-in-residence at Yale Medical School, and adjunct professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, about her new book, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Today on Conversations, Jonathan, we're talking with Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, lecturer at Yale, writer-in-residence at Yale Medical School, and adjunct professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, about her new book, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Welcome, Dr. Epstein.
Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. I must say, I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of books that we get sent, and the title of your book is Arousing. And the titles of the chapters are very exciting, and we're going to dive right in just a minute. But we'd like to know just a little bit about you first. How did you get interested in medical journalism, in healthcare, and in this topic?
Okay, well, I don't have time, I guess, to go into my entire life story and all the questions I asked myself. But basically, I've been interested in both medicine and writing for a long time. And while I went to medical school, I don't practice medicine. I teach medical writing. I write about medicine. But I'm really interested in what I like to call that gray zone of medicine. You're both physicians, so you understand that hardly anything is black and white in medicine. And everything that's not black and white has so much to do with society, culture, our belief system. That's what I love to dig into and try to understand, how we make decisions when there's uncertainty. And in terms of this book, when I was really looking into newspapers, old newspapers from the 1800s, 1900s, talking to people, talking to menopausal women like myself, raising four children who have gone through puberty. Now three of them are out of their teens. And listening to a lot of their friends, I realized there is so much confusion when it comes to hormones. So I wrote this book because I really wanted to set the record straight. I want to talk about some of the ridiculous, outrageous claims, which make for great stories. But I also want people to appreciate some of the fabulous advances in science as well.
Would you be able to read us a little bit from your book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And the section I'm reading right now, I love because I'm actually there. I'm at Yale now, a few floors above hundreds of jars of pickled brains. So I'll just read to you these few paragraphs and we can talk about it more. Two floors below the main reading room in Yale's medical school library is a room full of brains. Not the students. These brains are not housed in bodies. They're in jars. Some containers hold one brain, others a few slices. There are about 500 side by side in glass cases that wrap the perimeter. In the center, there's another shelf of brains suspended from the ceiling over a long table surrounded by stools. You can study there if you're not distracted by the scenery. These specimens were collected by Harvey Cushing, a pioneering neurosurgeon of the first decades of the 20th century. When he operated on people with brain tumors, he'd save a piece of brain and tumor and stick it in a jar. Some had tiny tumors, some had massive ones. Often, he'd get the rest of the brain after the patient died. Cushing also asked fellow surgeons to donate to his heady corpus. Cushing's own brain is not part of the compilation. It was cremated with the rest of his body in 1939. Yet the brains, marinating in formaldehyde and hidden for nearly half a century, are souvenirs from Cushing's most audacious operations and scrupulous studies. For more than 50 years after his death, these specimens, along with their accompanying notes and photographs, a treasure trove of medical history, became a jumble of cracked jars, dusty records, and glass plates shoved into various crannies of the hospital and medical school. In the mid-1990s, they were discovered in the basement by a few drunken medical students. After a colossal effort of cleaning and organizing the material, the brains found their final resting place in the Cushing Center. The room, which holds about three-quarters of the collection, was specially designed for them and opened in June 2010. The non-restored jars, about 150 in various states of pickled disarray, remain in the basement of a student dormitory, waiting to be, if not quite revived, refreshed. If you take it all in, the library brains, the basement ones, the notes, and the images, you step back in time to the very earliest days of brain hormone research, the days when Cushing proposed a theory that connected mind and body.
Wow, this is our famous Dr. Cushing, the Cushing syndrome, the Cushingoid habitus that doctors study.
That's exactly right. The same guy who, in addition to doing all the stuff you just said, took a year off of medicine to write a book about his mentor, William Osler, and got a Pulitzer Prize for that. He's also the same guy that would quickly draw sketches of the people that he operated on, and they look like fine art. He didn't do anything unless he did it, like, to the best quality you can possibly do it. He was quite an accomplished person.
So I'm assuming that Cushing wasn't the first person to be studying hormones, although he made some significant progress with research that he did or advancements he did. But give us a synopsis of how long have we understood a concept of hormones? Where did this idea come from?
Sure. Like all things in medicine, there always seems to be, here's the starting point, and then it's like, oh, wait, but someone actually had that idea years earlier. We just ignored that person. So same thing with hormones. We tend to think that the field of endocrinology began in the early 1900s, and it did. However, there was this wonderful experiment done in 1848 by a German doctor in his backyard. I have the details in my book, but basically in a nutshell, this German doctor did one thing that scientists are, I think, what I think of a great scientist doing. You know, great scientists, yes, they answer the question correctly, but what makes them great is that they knew the best question to ask. So this German doctor in his backyard wondered, do glands work? Whatever these glands do they work wherever they are in the body? So he was interested in testicles, and he had a bunch of roosters, and he castrated some. And then what he did was he took a testicle from one rooster and put it into the belly of another castrated rooster. So he had this rooster with nothing between its drumsticks but this testicle in the loops of its intestine. And voila, it worked. It made the castrated rooster start chasing hens again, get a red comb. So this German doctor, Dr. Berthold, did another thing right. He asked a good question. He answered it. He did a good study. He wrote it up in a medical journal. And then the one thing he didn't do was really appreciate the ramifications of his finding that, wow, he's describing the body in a way that's never been described before. So he just kind of shoved this article in a journal, I guess, put it on a shelf, and it was ignored for the next half century. So it wasn't until 1905 where doctors started doing similar sorts of experiments, and then they discovered this discovery. And they were the ones, these doctors Bayliss and Starling in England in 1905, to come up with the word hormone and come up with this new theory. So that gets to the title of my book, Aroused. It's not this misleading sex book, though there is sex and libido in the book. There's other things, too, like growth hormone and insulin and hormone replacement therapy and other things that hormones do. But in 1905, when the concept of hormones was rediscovered, and we just knew that we had these internal secretions that were really powerful, Dr. Sterling did what a lot of doctors do. He needed a good name. He wanted to come up with something from Greek. That's what doctors do. They look at Greek words and come up with some highfalutin name. So he went to his friend, who was a Cambridge University classics professor, and said, I'm looking for something that means to arouse, as in arousing other glands in the body, arousing the adrenal gland, arousing the pituitary gland. What's a word in Greek that means to arouse? And his friend said, what about something along the lines of hormoa? So that's how he came up with the word hormone.
I know that your conversation with us thus far is arousing. It's piquing interest. Though you're giving away some of the secrets of being a doctor, I don't know how I feel about that. But we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to continue a really fascinating conversation with Dr. Randi Hutter-Epstein, lecturer at Yale, and a new book she's written called Arouse, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. We've been talking with Dr. Randi Hutter-Epstein, lecturer at Yale and a writer-in-residence at Yale Medical School, about her new book, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. I wonder if we could just talk about any stories that you want to about a couple of hormones. I love the title of one chapter, and I read it wrong when I first did. I'm sure it's purpose, but I read testosterone entrepreneurs, but then I said, no, it's testosterone endopreneurs. Okay, that begs the story. What's going on?
Okay, so I didn't come up with the word endopreneur. Sort of doctors battling it out snarkily said it about some other testosterone people. So, you know, I think some of your listeners have probably seen commercials, if you watch any sporting events, that there's commercials for testosterone gels, and all you need to do if you're feeling tired at the end of the day, get some testosterone, boost your libido, you're 50 years old, you'll feel 20. So what I try to set out in this chapter is really to sort of set the record straight in terms of when someone might need testosterone, because I'm not saying it's always unnecessary, but when it may be unnecessary. The story that I loved in this book, and it takes place right here at Yale where I am now, is about a researcher in the 1950s who was interested in testosterone, but he was studying rats and then dogs. One of the things that he would do is he would fiddle with dog testosterone levels and then see how it affected their mating behavior, their tiredness. He actually did this, oddly so, in the basement of Yale's hospital at the time. That's where the dog lab was. And it was right next to the men's room, so people would complain, I guess, that they got dog smells in there, but whatever, I think they eventually moved him out. So he had a bunch of his dogs in the basement of the hospital, and he also had studied rats, and he came up with this theory that probably makes sense, that basically I'm just going to rephrase it for him, that he felt that in rats he really had complete control, like injecting testosterone in their brain, injecting into their bodies, and he could see the immediate effects. These rats would just mount any female rat after he would get them going. Some of the dogs he found were not as compliant. They weren't easy to control just with testosterone. They'd still reject the bitch after their testosterone went from low to normal, which made him conclude that possibly within a species, the more you have going on in the brain, the less direct control you have just from testosterone level to behavior. Not meaning that testosterone doesn't affect behavior, but that we hope when it comes to like human men that there's something else going on in your brain in addition to responding to testosterone.
We can only hope.
So could you tell us a little bit more? We've been hearing a lot about hormones and gender. If you'd be able to tell us the story of Bonnie Sullivan.
Sure. This story, it's shocking when people hear it now, but it really goes back to what we knew and what we considered about intersex. And this was, I mean, up until the 1950s, we considered people that were born with ambiguous genitalia, they were labeled hermaphrodites, which, you know, goes back to that Greek myth of, you know, the person that was both man and woman. Now we no longer use that term, fortunately, because it gives this freakish connotation. But in the 1950s, when a child was born with ambiguous genitalia, where the doctor, and this happened to Bonnie, who's now called Bo. So this child was born in 1956 in New Jersey. The doctor looked between the legs, wasn't quite sure, boy or girl, sedated the mother for another few days while he tried to figure out what to do. Without doing any tests, without doing any chromosomal tests, they weren't done then on babies that were born, he basically said to the mother, "You have a boy, but there's probably something wrong with its genitalia. Come back and see me in a year or so." So they went home. The mother noticed that this boy didn't look like he was urinating the way people said boys should, with projectile urination. Things just didn't seem 100% right, but this boy was sort of going through all the milestones that any child would, and a bright little kid. What happened next was they eventually did make it back to the doctor to figure out if there's anything going on. And this is when the story gets, what were we doing back in the 50s? This mother brought her 18-month-old to specialists at Columbia University, and the specialist said, "Let me take your child in. We might want to do some exploratory surgery to see what's going on." The doctor came out of surgery and said to the mother, "Oh, your doctor made a mistake at birth. You don't have a boy. You have a girl. So we noticed there's a uterus. We noticed there's ovaries. But what you thought was a penis was an enlarged clitoris. So just so this child would look more like a girl, we amputated the whole clitoris. And also, let's get rid of the name Brian. That was what the baby's birth name was. Let's come up with a different name. How about Bonnie? That's kind of close enough. And by the way, trash all his clothes, get rid of his trucks, get rid of his toys, get rid of any photographs that are kind of boy-looking photographs, and just start from scratch, and this child will be fine." You know, we're talking 18 months. So if you think about that, we're not talking 2 days. And even we know 2 days, you know, there's stuff that goes on. 18-month-old child, those kids are walking around. A lot of 18-month-olds are speaking. So all of a sudden, you're calling this 18-month-old by a different name. All of a sudden, you're throwing out all its toys. I mean, if any of there's parents listening, you can't even forget a favorite toy if you're going away for a weekend, but throwing all that out. So I tell this story to look at what we thought, not that these doctors were nasty, but at the time, the thinking was there were very clear-cut gender roles. Their thinking also was that up until 18 months, it's gender's malleable, that you're born with a blank slate, and it's all about your upbringing. It's all about how you're nurtured. So the thinking was, wow, they caught this right on time, right at 18 months. All you have to do is raise this child like a woman. And of course, as you can imagine, when Bonnie grew up and eventually saw her medical records, she was horrified. She was horrified that she had surgery that she didn't need to remove her clitoris. She was also horrified to see in her medical records the word hermaphrodite. No one had ever mentioned anything about that, and she didn't know until she saw it right there in the medical record. And now she's become really an activist for the intersex community. And right now, what people are still trying to get across is that we don't need to do these emergency surgeries on babies. What was considered an emergency in the 1950s, your child's genitals have to look exactly one sex or another. We're trying now to spread the word and for doctors and parents to appreciate that while it may be difficult to deal with issues of intersex, and while it may be difficult at times to do unnecessary surgery that's really only for cosmetics on a newborn, is something that does not have to be done. You can wait until a child's older and can make their own decisions.
You know, this is really sometimes unbelievable. It's mysterious, and it seems sometimes when we're faced with things we don't understand fully, the things that we concoct or do are really, in retrospect, indefensible. I wonder if there's anything, as we kind of wrap up, as you look forward, what do you see as on the horizon of what we could perhaps do differently if we maybe understood it better today than, you know, we think we may?
Well, I think we are. I mean, I actually think that there's an optimistic note at the end of my book, and I think that we are appreciating the complexities of hormones. I think that we're also appreciating now that, yes, hormones do control behavior. We're not always sure exactly how, so we can't just go online, which actually you can go online and buy a lot of wacky stuff, but I wouldn't recommend it. But in terms of future research, I think that we're looking into how hormones and the immune system interact, how all the gut bacteria that we know is so complicated that really makes us us, how they secrete hormones, how they interact with our own secretion of hormones. So we're really seeing this complexity. We're also realizing and finding wonderful ways to treat people, for instance, cancer survivors. We used to think that, okay, if we can not cure you, but some people are cured, some people have this chronic illness, but if you can survive cancer, that's wonderful, and we were done with our jobs as doctors. Now there's a whole field of endocrinology that focuses on cancer survivors so that they can be fertile, so that if they're young children, they can go through puberty. So there really is so much more that we're understanding and doing with hormones to help people live healthy and high-quality life.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Epstein, for joining us today on Your Health. This is a really fascinating. We'll put a link up on our website to your book. Encourage our listeners to grapple with it, to have some fun with it. It's a fascinating read, and I think you'll learn a lot, and we'll together hopefully avoid some of these problems that you describe in the past.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate that you invited me.
We've been talking with Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, lecturer at Yale, and writer in residence, Yale Medical School, adjunct professor, Columbia University, about her new book, Arouse, the History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. And you can get a copy of it, put it up on our link, understand a little bit more about castrated roosters and pickled brains and so much more. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, I'm joined by Laurel Sisler, one of our great guest co-hosts at UNC Family Medicine, who's going to help us answer your health questions and concerns. If you have a concern you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Laurel, we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I'm trying to be a savvy shopper and pay attention to the labels on the food that I buy. Does it matter when I'm buying bread if the label says whole grains versus whole wheat?
What a great question. I love that this listener is paying attention to their food labels. It sounds like this person is already doing that, but when you're looking at any type of carbohydrate, grain, pasta, bread, you really want to look for that very first ingredient on the ingredient list at the bottom of the nutrition label. And when it comes to whole wheat versus whole grain, that's really your personal choice. They're both good. The key word is that it says whole, whether it's whole spelt or whole rye or whatever kind of grain it is, it's wonderful. If you notice words like enriched or bleached, that's typically a sign that it's a more processed flour or processed grain and less good for you.
Well, and oftentimes I think when we think about whole grain, we just do think about it's whole wheat, but there are other parts to the grain rather than just the wheat. There's all portions of the grain kernel there. For many people, they might be synonymous. Multigrain would be more than just wheat. It would be other types of grains, barley, rye, that may be in there. You know, there's an interesting, I think Mayo Clinic has a very nice patient education sheet on the difference between those. May I ask our great friends at the health science librarians if they would just maybe make a link for that? I think some of our listeners would appreciate that. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I have a heart condition and am seen at an academic health center. For years now, I've seen a fellow who lasts 1 or 2 years and then graduates. Each time I have to get a new doctor, and it's really difficult since it's not just about my medical diagnosis, it's about my trust in my physician, knowing what's best for me and knowing my condition really well. Do you have any advice for me?
Thank you for a great question. We take for granted that people can form really strong relationships with their healthcare providers in a very short period of time, and sometimes it's not so simple, particularly if you have a lot of health conditions. And we see this in our primary care because the residents will be there, but they're usually there for 3 years. Some of the fellows, 2 years, occasionally 1 year. So it may be more difficult for some of the patients to form that relationship, particularly if they're only coming in once a year.
Yeah, and it's challenging. I mean, thinking through how to advocate for yourself, whether that is asking for a more stable provider, sometimes that's possible, sometimes it's not. Sometimes you can follow your doctor if they're going somewhere locally. Those are two things that come to mind.
Yeah, I think it doesn't hurt to ask. And certainly if you find that you don't think you're getting the care that you deserve, because you could get even better care. You may find that the fellow doesn't come in with some preconceived conditions about who you are and maybe spends even more time with you than perhaps an established, experienced, longer acting provider. But it may be that you feel that you might need that better care. And I think it's up to you if you feel that you can't get it in that academic health center. You could certainly ask for a private practitioner. But I think simply asking those within that center, reflecting on you think you maybe need someone who's going to be there. Maybe it's a team of doctors, maybe two doctors. Maybe it's a fellow teamed up with someone who's there for many years, who's likely to be there when the fellow leaves. You get the benefit of both. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I've heard that doctors can now call opiate prescriptions into the pharmacy for their patients. Does this also include other types of prescriptions that in the past I've had to see my doctor for, like those for anxiety?
Well, it's not quite as simple as just calling it in, like, this is Dr. Goldstein calling the pharmacy. Let's give all the patients who are on opiates their opiate prescriptions. It's not calling them in, but we can actually do electronic prescribing of opiate prescriptions through a two-step verification process. So, you know, I go through my code on my smartphone, and then I get a verification code. No one else can really do this. I can't be forged so easily. So I think it's trying to cut down on forgeries, but it does allow patients to get those prescriptions electronically, whereas before they had to come into the office. Now, that doesn't mean they shouldn't come into the office, and they won't come in the office at some times. I'm thinking, Laurel, you could probably think of reasons why patients still need to come in the office to be checked for those sorts of prescriptions.
Yeah, I agree. I was surprised when I initially heard this, but it does, after learning a little bit more about it, it seems like a win-win in terms of saving time for patients and making it easier and also reducing the chance that, yeah, somebody is forging a prescription for something as important as an opiate.
We also can request, and we do request, that the patients do come in for visits. So it may be that we could do refills on some of the medicines, like the anxiety medicines, but I'd want you to be seen twice a year. For the opiate medications, I may still want you to be seen twice a year to do the random drug screens, the other things that we need to do to assure good quality care. But you know what? If I'm out of town, or the patient's out of town, it's a patient we know, we run out, we don't have the problem that you're going to go through withdrawal or worse yet, go to a doctor who refuses to give you the medicine. So this is, I think, an improvement, something that I'm glad to see us using technology appropriately.
I agree.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls for our show today. And we want to thank all our listeners for joining us today. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. You can send us any questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine. I want to thank our great guest today, Dr. Randy Hutter-Epstein. I want to thank my guest co-hosts, Dr. Jonathan Fricke and Laurel Sisler. and we hope you'll join us again next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Laurel Sisler.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.